Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Tinseltown Tragedies Uncut. This particular episode contains an uncut interview whose portions were included in the Who Killed Krista Helm episode of the series. In this episode, we speak with Krista Helm's daughter, Nicole, who was only 9 years old at the time of her mother's unsolved murder. You can hear the episode Who Killed Krista Helm in its entirety at our website, at moviegeeksunited.net.
So tell me about your early life and your time with your mother and you know that whole thing.
Okay. When I was 2, my mom decided to move to New York City, and she didn't want to take me into that lifestyle. So her roommate at the time in Milwaukee knew a woman in Vermont that took care of elderly people and children, and that put me close enough to my mom for her to visit with me regularly. So she brought me to Vermont and paid this woman to take care of me here, and she would come back and forth and visit with me, and I would go to New York or Florida or wherever she was at the time and visit with her. So there was the memories I have and the life that I remember with her was kind of in and out here and there. Mm-hmm. But I was predominantly living here in Vermont.
And was she, what was her game plan? I mean, what did she tell you about what she was trying to do with her life?
Well, the plan had always been for me to go live with her when I turned 10, because she felt I'd be old enough at that age to be able to travel and to be able to really kind of fit into her lifestyle without it being too difficult for me. She felt I was too young to really be in that lifestyle. So the plan was always that when I turned 10, I would go live with her full time. And she had even in our last visit in the Hamptons, we had been talking about her adopting and me getting a sibling. So that she was planning on, as our last visits kind of winded down and we were getting closer to me being 10, she had talked a lot about getting out of the industry and us just being together and having a family and another sibling.
Yeah, yeah. And how often did you see her?
It varied. It was several times a year. She'd come to Vermont a couple times a year, and I'd go to New York a couple, 2, 3, maybe 4 times a year. And when she was filming in Florida, I spent some time down there. And then when she lived in California, I'd go for a whole summer one time and, you know, longer visits here and there. As I got older, the visits seemed to get, you know, larger and longer. My mm-hmm. last visit with her was in the Hamptons.
And how? And when was that in relation to her death?
It was, I believe, the summer before. I met her in New York. I flew to New York, and we took a train from New York to the Hamptons.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed in a house in the Hamptons for a couple weeks, I believe.
So was it, as a child, not having your mom there every kind of minute of your life, mm-hmm. was that easy to come to terms with, or was that a process for you?
It wasn't very easy. Unfortunately, the place that she left me wasn't a really good place for a kid. The gal that took care of me, the woman that took care of me, wasn't a really kind person. So it wasn't a great environment for me to be in. And I, you know, being young, you don't really know that there's anything wrong. I just know that going to see my mom was like the greatest thing in the whole world, because it was, you know, movie stars and dressmakers and plays and David Copperfield shows. And it was very glamorous and very exciting. And she was beautiful and very kind to me. So going to see her was just the highlight of my life. I remember mm-hmm. just getting so incredibly excited to be with her.
So tell me about the most memorable moments when you would visit her in places like New York or L.A.
Every time I went to New York, she would take me to Central Park, and we would ride on a horse and buggy and get a hot dog, and just that was kind of our tradition every time I went there. It was a very fond memory of her taking me to the zoo in New York City. That was really nice. And when I was in Florida with her, that was really fun. She did a lot of neat stuff. We were out in the Everglades a lot, and she actually had me on the set. I still remember all the lines of that particular scene. And when the movie actually, when Gopher Broke launched in Cincinnati, she flew me out for the opening, and that was really exciting. The mayor was there and gave her a bunch of, you know, really cool little symbols of the city that she later gave to me. And then as I got older, there was a time when I went out to see her in California, and it was right around my birthday and my summer vacation. I thought she had forgotten about it, and she actually had a surprise birthday party for me that night in a really sweet restaurant. So those, and, you know, just watching her put her makeup on and be so glamorous all the time, she was just, she was a movie star in every sense of the word.
Yeah. And you were actually able to see, you know, movie stars, entertainers. I mean, she hung out with,
I remember one time I was in her living room and we were sitting on a big wraparound couch in California, and there was a fellow sitting next to me in the living room, and I was very young, I was probably like 6, and he just had the craziest lips I'd ever seen, and I was just fascinated watching his mouth. And years later I saw a picture of him and it was Mick Jagger. I'm like, that's the guy that was on my mom's couch. I remember those lips. And I learned how to swim in Engelbert Humperdinck's pool, and, you know, I have some really bizarre memories.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, she was making quite an impression and quite a life for herself. Your mother sounds like she was very determined, but also very assertive and self-empowered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She very much so was, you know, and given her childhood, I mean, she had a lot of challenges in her childhood. So she had a really strong internal strength and drive.
Mm-hmm. Where, and you think that that's where it came from? I mean, did she desperately want to get out of where she was in Milwaukee, and did that come from her childhood, do you think?
I, from what I'm told about her as a child, from like a very, very early age, she knew she wanted to be a movie star. And that was like her direction from a really early age. She just always knew that's what she wanted to do, and nothing was going to stand in her way. So no matter, I mean, she had a form of scoliosis, so she had to wear a brace for most of her high school years. So she had a lot of different kinds of struggles, but she still always had her, you know, her eye on the prize. She was going to be a movie star. And she never really, from what I'm told, she never really strayed from that being her direction.
Mm-hmm. And what is, and forgive me if anything I ask is too personal and you don't want to answer it, just please let me know. But what was her relationship, as you understand it, with your grandparents, with her parents?
Her dad, she was just so tight with my grandpa. My grandpa, I think, is probably the person that loved her most on the planet. He was just so proud and so supportive. He actually had a kind of a background role in Gopher Broke. She flew him down there and put him in the movie because they were just best friends, very, very, very tight. And she was his oldest, so they had a really strong, very deep relationship. And when she died, he was the person the family worried the most about because he struggled. Oh, he struggled. It was heartbreaking for him.
Let me ask you about this Let's Go for Broke film, because I had spoken with Steven about it, and he kind of made it his mission to try to track it down. Mm-hmm. Were you finally able to see it, and if you were, what was that experience like?
Well, it was kind of interesting because probably a decade and a half ago, my Aunt Marisa, my mother's sister, and I believe it was her, had some luck, possibly with John. There's so many players in this, it's hard to remember the details over a 30-year period. Someone had tracked down, I believe it was Marisa, an actual film role from the filming of Gopher Broke, but it was only the beginning of the film. So she tracked it down, she brought it to a theater, and she got it transferred onto a DVD. So we had that, which was really, I actually still have that reel. And so that was the first time I'd ever seen it. And again, it was only the beginning of the film, but I really have like incredible memories of this film. And it wasn't the parts of the memories, but it was neat to see her alive and talking and walking. And I'd always been told I was a lot like her. I looked like her. I kind of had her aura, as people say. But seeing her was the first time I'd ever really seen that, because now I'm an adult. And the people, my whole family was with me, and everyone was saying, oh my gosh, it is amazing, even though she wasn't an influence in your life, how much like her I am. So that was really neat. And then when we got the full film, when we were doing the 48 hours within all that investigation, we finally got a hold of the full film, and I have it on DVD, as do my children and many other people. And it was really neat to watch him because the scenes in the Everglades that I was down there and I was part of were very familiar to me. And I got to see the scenes that I memorized all these years. So I got to see the full picture of it and really see all the different faces. That film kind of shows all the different faces of my mom, which is kind of neat. It shows her strength. It shows, you know, her femininity. It shows her kind of out there-ness. So it was a really neat way to get to know her.
Well, and it's such a unique and kind of blessed gift to have this of her.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So
yeah, I do feel very blessed. I'm really grateful to have that.
So tell me what how you found out about her murder. You were 9?
I was 9, and I was originally told, I remember it very vividly to this day. I was sitting in my kitchen, and the gal, who I call the nanny, the lady that got paid to take care of me in Vermont, was on the phone, and she wasn't generally really nice to me, and she pulled out still remember to this day, some strawberry and some chocolate wafer cookies, and she put them in front of me, and she sat down, and she told me that my mom had been killed in a car accident. And, you know, that was hard, but there wasn't a big hole in my life. I was kind of numb that night. And the next day I went to school and we were all lined up in the back of the school. And it just kind of hit me all of a sudden that I wasn't going to go. It was 6 months shy of when I was supposed to go live with her. So it kind of hit me at school and I fell apart and cried and freaked out. And about 2 weeks after that, someone at school had found a newspaper article with the true story about what had happened to her, and they were bringing it to school, and a teacher intercepted it. So I was pulled out of class that day. I didn't know what was going on. And the principal of the school at the time, actually, who was very involved in helping me and taking care of me, she was really sweet, took me out of the school and brought me out to McDonald's and had a whole conversation about bad people in the world. And I later learned that my mom had actually been murdered, but it was only because it came out in this article and a kid brought it to school that anyone decided I needed to know the truth.
Mm. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
And yeah. Was there, on your family's part, like your mom's dad, or was there an attempt to try to find out what happened to her?
What I'm told by my family is that when she died, first of all, everybody, as one of my aunts puts it, they were also paralyzed by the pain of it. So it took them a while to get her body back and get my grandfather. He was an on-the-road salesperson, so they needed to get him back to Milwaukee. And everybody kind of gathered, and they were so paralyzed by the pain that there wasn't a whole lot of immediate kind of jumping on the case by the family. And when the family started to call the LAPD and try to look into the case, my grandfather was told by the LAPD, and this is, again, what I was told, so it's, hearsay, but that they really didn't have the manpower to investigate the case, but he was welcome to hire a private investigator. And my family didn't have those kinds of means at the time, and they were just so traumatized by what had happened that they're very spiritual, very kind souls, all of them. So they kind of just backed off from it to just deal with the pain, from what I've been told.
And
so there wasn't a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So when did you kind of assume the mission of trying to get out there and finding out what happened?
Probably around 18, when I received, I never knew, the nanny never really told me what was going on, and she was being paid foster care funds and my Social Security or something to take care of me all those years. When I turned 18, I got her life insurance checks in the mail, and I also received her residuals from Wonder Woman and Starsky and Hutch for, at that time, 9 years, I think, no, yeah, 10 years, 8, 9 or 10 years, somewhere in there. So they had tallied up all of the residuals, which are like 19 cents for some of them, you know, and they sent me a check from Screen Actors Guild as well. So when I received those, it kind of stimulated me into, because I had been told certain things by the nanny as I was growing up, which were completely inaccurate. So as I received these monies, I realized that it kind of stimulated stuff inside of me to go, you know, maybe it's not what she's been telling me all these years. Maybe my mom, because she told me my mom didn't want me. You know, it was a very unhealthy scenario. So I started kind of looking into it. And back then, there wasn't the internet. There really wasn't a whole lot of ways to get involved in a case other than the telephone. So I tracked down the homicide detective, kind of the office in LA that handled the case at the time, and just said, you know, how do I get it reopened? How do I get it looked at? How do I get information? And that just kind of launched it. So folks that started taking a look at the case for me in LA started asking a lot of questions too, because there was a lot of stuff that was just not right about the case. And it's a very fascinating case. So detectives started to get a little more interested, and the cold case detectives came into play within the next few years. And each set of cold case detectives, I've worked with three different sets at this point, got real excited in the beginning. You know, they see all this stuff and they see all these holes and they get really excited and launch out. But what I found each and every time is they have such an overload of cases that it kind of, when they don't get anywhere, they just move on to the next case, is what kind of what I'm seeing as the cycle of activity around the case.
Yeah. And there's so many characters involved in this. I mean, your mother knew so many people. From the highest rollers to you know, people that might have been kind of questionable, come from questionable backgrounds. It's a bit of a labyrinth, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, people are constantly asking me who I think did it and what I think. And I've had my theories over the years. I've never been able to really prove anything or really fully disprove anything, because there's just so many, like you said, there's so many characters involved. And I think what happens is the police, it's a big, giant, tangled web. And a lot of people have passed away, and there's, you know, very mixed memories. So I think they get all enthusiastic and excited, and then the tangled web just is too big for them to take on. They need, you know, they need a whole crew to do it.
Why do you think it wasn't because, I mean, just as looking at the media and how they are, what kinds of stories they look for. I mean, so many aspects of your mother's story, it's the stuff of, you know, kind of Hollywood gossip heaven. So why wasn't it covered more when it occurred, do you think?
You know, I have probably, right around the time she died, I maybe have like 6 or 8 different articles that were written in the area on the case. I think from what I've been told, and I've never really sussed out this information, but there were so many murders at that time in that area, and starlets were, you know, a big target. And also shortly thereafter, I believe the Hollywood Strangler came into play. So there was a lot of media put on other cases at the time, and she was a nobody. You know, she really was a nobody. She'd only been in a couple bit parts. I think that the police didn't really give it a lot of attention. I don't think the media gave it super lot of attention. They only gave it attention for the name she was attached to, not necessarily for her.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so what has become, tell me about this journey of investigating your mother's murder, because there had to have been kind of leads that you were looking into that led nowhere, or that you eventually dismissed. Tell me about this journey that you've been on.
I've received different pieces of information. I think the best part of the journey has been getting to know who my mom is and connecting with people that actually knew her during her life, because I was so young. I didn't really know her that well. So that part of the journey has actually been a real gift and a real blessing, and I'm incredibly thankful for that. Each time that I kind of dive into it, I find something new. And I remember at one point connecting with, and again, it was like through 15 different phone calls and people giving me names, connecting with the gentleman that she spent her last night with. And he's in the 48-hour special. He was at one point her roommate, and then he spent the night with her last night, and he had been dating this other woman that's also in the 48-hour special, and they had recently split up, and he and my mom kind of hooked up basically her last night. And this other woman had found out about it. So he was the person that I had connected with a few years ago that really gave me a broad amount of information. And I can send you all his contact info. he was really lovely, and he gave me a lot of information and told me basically that he had given the police some information, was really surprised that they had never followed up on this other woman. And so that was a big, you know, when I talked to him, that opened up 15 different channels that I looked into. And one of the things I did is I wrote to the woman, and she wrote me back with some really bizarre stuff. So I kind of pointed the police in her direction. And I remember the police saying, you know, well, we don't know where she is. And I, at that time, computers were in play. And I said, well, I just Googled her, and I have her address and her phone number in front of me. So, you know, that opened up a whole other direction. I'm like, wow, you can't find her, but I just did. It was, you know, a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and it was all accurate, all the information I Googled, because she actually happened to have a production business. So that opened up a whole other avenue. I think that the biggest thing that happened during this journey that kind of launched it into a real broad base of information and directions and really kind of sussing things out finally was 48 Hours coming on board. The fellow that I worked with at 48 Hours was a young producer, very excited and wanted to do it, but they weren't doing unsolved cases at that time. So he spent about a year and a half trying to convince them to do this story. When he launched it, finally, there were investigators, there were reporters, there were people that were traveling and looking into all the different directions. So that is really the biggest investigative piece of all of this, and it sussed out a lot of stuff for us. It brought some things to the surface, and it put some things to bed. But unfortunately, again, it kind of got left behind by the police. There were all these directions that they were supposed to follow up, and I believe they didn't follow, my impression is they didn't follow up on everything they could have based on the fact that they're overloaded.
Well, just, you know, I was introduced to your mom's case based upon that 48 Hours episode, and I don't know what edit of it that I saw, but the way it ended was incredibly frustrating because it was showing the detectives going to the woman's house, who was an acquaintance of your mother, and taking a DNA sample because she said that she had no idea who your mother was, and then the episode ended. So, what was
it wasn't
the
a match.
Of that? Okay.
It wasn't a
okay.
match. They actually have tested a few women, one of which is the gal that's in the 48 Hours special, the one that's playing the piano and singing. She was the person that I launched the desire to have her tested, because she's the one that I found on Google. And they went and they tested her and they didn't find it. What I get frustrated with is they go after one thing, and if it's not an answer, they pretty much are dropping the case. So they didn't really follow up on her in any other way, and that's what kind of keeps happening. Is, you know, we get really excited about a direction. If it doesn't work out, they just stop again.
So did you say that they did, I think her name is Danilo. Did you say that they did test her and it did not
yes,
match?
Yes, it wasn't a match.
Okay. To your knowledge,
but that didn't
necessarily. Right. But to your knowledge, have they tested every kind of prominent female in her life from that time?
Yes. The ones that we're aware of.
So where did they get the female DNA? What led them to believe that this might be the act of a female?
It was under her nails. And they did keep, when they went through the files, when Brandon Merg and everybody went through the files, this last team that worked on it, they found a jumpsuit that she was wearing. I think it was Brandon Merg, maybe the guy before found the jumpsuit, and her jewelry. And in addition to that, they found fingernail samples that had been taken at the time. And the samples weren't big enough to do a, like, full-on. They could either say, yes, it was, could be this person, or yes, it could not be this person. And when they tested them after, it took 3 years to get them tested, mind you. When they finally got them tested, it came up with female DNA, which, you know, threw the detectives for a loop, everybody. But I always believed, because the reports in the neighborhood said that there were two female and one male boys heard yelling outside. And there were also, in my opinion, two different instruments. And a lot of the detectives feel the same way. It was a knife and something else. So she was bludgeoned and stabbed. And that, they believe it was two people that did it.
And what can we glean from the nature of her wounds? I mean, first of all, this was no simple mugging. This was extremely personal.
I've actually been to the site, and I've seen the they do a sketch after someone's killed this way with the order of the stab wounds and what happened. And my mom was a black belt, so I knew she wouldn't just be attacked and not fight back. She was also an incredible fighter in general. She, the original stab wound was in her upper back. So that first stab wound, she had no idea anyone was behind her. And if you go to the site, it's a very dark, narrow little street, and where she was walking out of, somebody could have very easily been on the side of the building waiting for her to come out right on the street. And so that was the first stab wound. In addition to all of the ones on her body, her hands were very cut up. So she clearly fought very hard and was stabbed all over her hands. There were a lot of wounds on her hands from the knife. So they, you know, there is this strong belief that there were two assailants at the time, and that she just had, you know, no way, that she couldn't fight back. She had already been stabbed in the back, and she was, you know, being attacked on two different levels.
Oh, goodness. So you're these people that said that there are these multiple voices, I would imagine they're ear witnesses from the neighborhood that evening?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
So that's a very tiny little, like, Hollywood upper, or at least it was when I was there, you know, upper income neighborhood. The street that she was killed on is so narrow that I believe only one car at a time could make it down. That's what we were looking at. And her car was parked around the corner, so it was such a narrow street. But if you stand on the street, there's windows and houses everywhere.
Mm. And are the, I'm sorry, one more question about the
sure.
wounds. Are the wounds consistent with something being caused by two separate people, or is
yes.
there any way to tell that?
Yes.
Okay.
There was, and again, I've had a couple different sets of detectives say when they looked at the case and looked at those documents, they felt the same way. There were two different instruments used.
Oh, gosh. So tell me about, she was going to see...
Yeah, he was, you know, I've gotten different pieces of information on this fella throughout the years. One was that he was, you know, a casual lover of hers. And others were that he was her agent. I never met the fella. I have no idea. And from what I was told, the police went to interview him right after, and he said he slept through. He didn't even wake up when she came by the house. And in his interview, when I read the interview, it just kind of stuck out to me that he, you know, immediately said, well, I didn't kill her. You know, that came out of his mouth very quickly, and it kind of... The way that it fell into the conversation concerned the cold case detectives as well. But he disappeared shortly thereafter, and nobody could find him. Since I've been working on the case, nobody's ever been able to find him.
Sanford Smith is his name, right?
Yep. Yep.
I mean, that was a big piece of it that I had a question about too. Because, I mean, everything I read in the 48 Hours piece, I mean, she's going to visit him. They don't know if. She was coming or going whenever she was attacked, but I heard absolutely no follow up on this agent, and it seems like the obvious
no.
place to start was
where
she was actually
going
to see. Yeah.
Well, and if you go to the site, the interesting thing is I went and I got the reports from the police before I went to the site, and one of the things in the reports were that her keys were under her, and the place where her body laid on the street. In my opinion, as I walked the site with the information I had, is that she was coming out of his house or coming down, because there were stairs around his front door that were kind of like kind of tucked in, because the carport's there and then the stairs come out onto the street. And the way that her body was laying to me, it gave me the impression, and the detectives, that she was leaving, because A, her keys were under her. So when you leave somewhere, you're holding your keys to go to your car, you know? And her keys were under her, so we believe she was stepping down from the stairs as she was stabbed in the back. So it could have been coming out of the apartment or someone from the street by the way her body lay.
Mm. Generally, from what you can gather, how was she regarded amongst the circle of people that she knew? What do people feel about your mom?
I've been given mixed information by everybody. My mom was not a small personality. So she basically had a lot of followers, a lot of people that, you know, wanted to kind of be in her sphere. and she also talked to the people that she really needed. She was pretty bold.
So what do you think is the most, well, I don't know if I can even ask it this way because there's still so many questions, but what to you seems like a likely scenario?
I've had my theories over the years. They've been disproved. So at this point, I can't settle on any particular scenario. The information is too broad. Mm-hmm. You know, I had my thoughts. I mean,
I think your phone's breaking up just a little bit. It's going in and out.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Nope. Yes, I'm so sorry. That's fine. That's good.
Okay. My last theory was that the drug dealer that they investigated who's dead, they were actually going to exhume his body and do DNA testing until we found out it was female DNA. I do believe he was involved.
And so tell me about this gentleman. How did your mother make his acquaintance, and what role did he play in her life?
I'm not sure how she made his acquaintance. He was a pretty as a drug dealer and criminal, and kind of had like a really bad, very violent reputation around things. And my mom had been storing her things. He was also the roommate of the fella she spent the last night with. They were under the same roof. And my mom was storing things in his house. There had been some conflict around that. I've also heard rumors there was conflict around drug money. I don't know how true that is. I've never sussed it out. Again, I've been so surprised so many times in this case that I don't really, you know, rule anything out. I believe that he was involved. I believe that he and my mom had a conflict from what I was told, and he was incredibly violent. He also at one point had admitted to someone that he killed her. And the interviews with his wife, the way she describes him, he was violent and scary and really just insanely crazy, and the way that she was killed was pretty crazy.
And even though he had kind of confessed to someone else or kind of bragged about having been responsible for it, when the police actually first spoke to him, he flat out denied it, of course, right?
Absolutely. Right, of course.
Yeah.
But I don't think he did it. There was a woman with him when he did it. It's just a question as to what woman was with him.
The other question I had about the 48 hours is the show, because it also ended right when they said, you know, we're going to follow up this theory of the Salminio connection, because it's a huge coincidence that it happens a year to the day in the same area, and that's enough.
But if you look at the cases, they're completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was robbed and stabbed one time.
Okay. Was he spoken to, though? Because he was out of prison at that time.
He was, and he was spoken to. And they never, again, they didn't really follow up very strong on that one either. You know, I kept calling and asking about it, and they were like, oh, we know where he is. We don't know where he is. We talked to him. He said he didn't do it. We don't have any DNA to connect him. So that was a frustrating kind of direction as well. That was one of the many things that I was like, oh, here we are.
You know, when I'm talking about all these cases on this series that I'm doing, it's just so, I mean, there's obviously a lot of pain and a lot of loss involved in it, but also the incredible frustration. It's a human nature thing where you where you desperately want to know what is potentially unknowable, but in these cases, we know that the answer is right there. It's probably right there in front of us, and I can imagine how added the frustrations are that this is your own mother.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating. And what's the most frustrating piece of it is that there's really, I mean, I've done pretty much everything I can possibly do, and we still have no answer. And I think the reason we don't have answers is, as one of the detectives put it, you know, the real world doesn't operate the way that we do on these shows. You know, you don't get DNA that day. Like I said, it took 3 years to get DNA on her nails. So things are not as we think they should be, especially in California and in the area that she was murdered. There, we had to, you know, apply for a grant to get her nails tested. You know, there's an insane amount of layers to every single step, and when you're working with a case this complicated, it literally could be a full-time job for several people. So that's been incredibly frustrating, and you know, it's just the reality of the world that we live in. But that's been so frustrating that every little step we take literally takes years for them to do it. You know, interviewing someone can take them up to a year to get the funding to go to New York and interview somebody, you know. So that's, and I think what happens is the case loses steam each time we have those long lags.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, too. I spoke with Darlene yesterday, I think it was. And, you know, Darlene received a card from your mom not too long before she was killed, and which really strongly indicates that she knew that she was in danger. So did you see that card? I mean, do you believe that your mother thought that she was in danger?
I do. I think that, you know, I believe that Darlene received that card, and I believe that my mom, from all accounts, was into some pretty, you know, scary stuff here and there, you know, in different directions, as you've seen. You know, it could be the drugs, it could be the people in the music industry, the people in the movie industry. There's different directions that she was tangled up in at that time. That I do believe she probably sensed it, because my last visit with her, our whole conversation was how she wanted to just stop and get away from it altogether, and we were going to be a family, and you know, she didn't have a desire to continue in the industry, and there was a reason for it. She just sensed me because I was nine.
So part of what I want to do in this series too is obviously pique interest in the questions involved in each of these cases, but mostly I do want to paint these figures that are normally painted as just victims. I want to show them for their humanity, because I think that's overlooked. So excuse me, I wanted to know from you, what are the most important aspects of your mother that you want people to know about her?
She was an incredible survivor. She really was. She survived an awful lot and just kept moving forward, you know, to the day she died. She was pushing her life forward. She wasn't one to settle into life. She was one to make life happen for her, and she never gave up. You know, she was like a dog with a bone when it came to what she wanted to do as far as being, you know, in Hollywood and being a movie star. I think that she had an incredible, from what I'm told, love and compassion, and she was so gentle and kind and sweet to me that there's been a lot of pictures painted of her that she was this, you know, hardcore, go after what you want, you know, step on people, which from what I'm told she did do. But I also think that I really want people to take away that she was a kind, loving, wonderful mom. When I was with her, she was so good to me, and she was so kind, and she drew people. She just had a charisma and an energy that people that knew her never forgot her. I can't tell you how many people have come to me and given me beautiful memories and love stories around her. And that's been really, really helpful. And that's what I think I want people to remember. She's such goodness in her.
Yeah, it's obvious to me that she had something within her that drew people to her, that there was this very kind of open, good natured quality a lot of times that just people wanted to, you know, be around. So tell me what the Brandenburg and Harris, are those the two cold cases on it right now? Okay.
Yeah. Well, they were during the 48 hours case, and they were sussing out some other stuff. They went to, since the show has ended, they, you know, one of the bones they bit onto was something around the gal that owned the prostitution room. I can't remember who she was. She was huge in the news for a while. So something that they mentioned her in the 48 hours as well. My mom was connected, and they actually went and talked to her, and I never could quite figure out what they were doing. But sometimes they don't tell me stuff. I've noticed that too. That's been frustrating when they don't tell me things that they found. I have to, like, call them, take 6 months to get through to them, and then they tell me something like, oh, we went and interviewed this lady 6 months ago. So they did, you know, they do some stuff like that I'm unaware of, so I don't know exactly where they are in the case because they haven't called me back. I actually stopped calling them about a year ago. I just got frustrated and decided to try other avenues.
Okay. And there, I forgot to ask you about this because we've spoken about the the really kind of vicious guy that she that first bragged about having a role in it and then denied it.
Yes.
But she had, and it's probably completely inadvertently, but I mean, there were mob kind of presences in her throughout her life.
Yes. And I think that was what she was scared of. I think having learned more information around that, I think that would probably be the only thing that would say my mom is something that big and powerful.
Yeah. Where did this start? I mean, I understand that there was a mob activity in Milwaukee when she was young, but how do you think that presence followed her throughout her life, and what form did it take?
I think my opinion, knowing what I know, and again, I don't know every little detail, but my opinion is that it was the lifestyle she was in. You know, movie stars ran with mafia. So I think that in New York as well as in Florida, via the lifestyle she lived, she came into contact with mafia-style people, and she was a strong woman, and I'm sure that she, you know, was noticed, and that's how she got connected